contacting whistleblowers and journalists and to advocate for the release of Julian Assange. That's midnight on Thursday, Radio Unnameable, here on listener-sponsored, non-commercial, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays after the WBAI Evening News at 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. It is now 1 minute past 7 p.m.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It is time for Off the Hook. Welcome to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Yes, we're on the air this week, we intend to stay on the air for the entire hour. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by, this is really, if only this was video. It is video for us, but Emmanuel, I'm joined by Kyle over on the other side of the studio.
Yeah, what?
thanks for pulling all that together. Rob T. Firefly, hold on a second, I got to press this button now. Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Over there in Queens, along with Gila, also in Queens.
Good evening.
And Alex, you know, we've been spending the last 10 minutes trying to track you down because it was like you were a fugitive or something. We were trying to find you, and you weren't answering, and now you suddenly just popped up on the screen. You're in a car. Where are you right now?
I'm in a car. That's right. I'm en route to Pennsylvania. My garage company in New York really screwed me today by delaying getting my car out a half an hour. And at rush hour, for about every 1 minute you delay getting on the road, that equals another 5 or 10 minutes on the road. So, coming to you from the car.
Why do you need a company to get your car out of a garage? I can do that myself.
Well, it would be very difficult because this is a garage that I use where it's a big building in the West Village that's converted.
You know what? We don't have time for this. I'm sorry. Maybe on overtime we can talk about your garage, but we have a limited amount of time. As people know, we were not on last week. It was a mistake, and we're not going to talk about it because we're going to spend all the time talking about the fact that we weren't on the air. It's a waste of time. Sometimes people make mistakes, and we're just going to live with that and move on. And what WBAI is doing for us in exchange for that mistake is unpreempting us for next week. We weren't going to be on next week, but guess what? We are going to be on next week. So, yeah, all's well that ends well. Well, not really quite like that, but it's okay. I wasn't really in the best of moods anyway last week because I had just come out of a medical procedure and I was recovering from that. I'm still recovering from that, but we still have a lot of things to talk about. We had something happen to us 2 weeks ago that I think we should not forget about because that was a true injustice. Somebody reported our show, our overtime show. That's the one that follows this one on YouTube. Apparently somebody reported it. We were talking about the importance of getting a vaccine and not listening to people who are spouting nonsense and spreading fear. And someone reported it as us spreading medical misinformation, and YouTube took the show down. they sent us this notice saying that yes, we are YouTube has removed your video. Here's what you can do. And the thing that you really can't do is talk to a person because they don't really have any of those. But basically they said, hi, Channel 2600, our team has reviewed your content, and unfortunately, we think it violates our medical misinformation policy. We've removed the following content from YouTube. Folks, this is why you do things yourself. This is why you don't rely on a big company like Google to decide things for you. Because when you do that, and when you have artificial intelligence making the decisions are wrong lots and lots of times. And this was simply unbelievable to all of us. Where we talked about it on social media, and people were outraged. It didn't last very long because we forwarded a very strongly worded appeal to whatever bot handles that, a couple hours later, we got an email. Channel 2600, we reached a decision on your appeal. After taking another look, we can confirm that your content does not violate our community guidelines. Thanks for your patience while we reviewed this appeal. Our goal is to make sure content doesn't violate our community guidelines so that YouTube can be a safe place for all. And sometimes we make mistakes trying to get it right. We're sorry for any frustration our mistake caused you, and we appreciate you letting us know. Okay, you know, I like apologies, even when they come from computers, but I think there's a bigger problem here. The problem is that this can be done so easily. In fact, I'm going to ask whoever did this last time to do it again this week. Let's see how easy it is. Do it every damn week. Report us for spreading medical misinformation by telling people that it's important to get a vaccine against COVID-19. You know, Rob, what do you think about this? Is this how it works? Is this how all these massively complex systems are set up, that all somebody has to do is simply say something is true and they will act as if it is until somebody says otherwise?
Well, that's always the way it goes with systems like YouTube, where it's not humans handling the complaints, at least not on the first line of defense. It's computers, and it's been shown time and again that if you report something enough, whether or not that report is legitimate, it will get taken down. People have used this as a harassment tool to all sorts of people. All sorts of innocent people have found their videos taken down, demonetized. If they're making a living off of things, that can make things especially rough. And it's actually unusual, I think, for sense to prevail and these things to get appealed properly and reviewed properly by a person. So we're kind of lucky in that respect.
Well, if you know how to phrase an angry sentence, that helps. If you have the weight of a radio station in back of you, that helps. If you have the hacker community speaking up for you, that certainly helps. But yes, you're right. There are many instances, we've talked about it on this very show, where common sense does not prevail. And there are certain topics that if you run afoul of, you can find yourself having your video turned off. And we don't care about the monetization. We don't do that. But a lot of people do, as you mentioned.
It still runs ads, though.
Yeah, it does. Wait, what?
Unless they're premium customers.
So wait, you mean even though we don't get anything out of it, people have to see ads when they watch our videos?
I believe so. And then if you're using a web browser, I think it would depend on if you have a blocker of some kind.
See, we do this just because it's convenient, not because we endorse it. Anyway, the other topics that you could run afoul of: harmful or dangerous content policies, violent or graphic content policies. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading their policies, but these are the topics that they have policies about. Violent criminal organizations, hate speech, harassment and cyberbullying, and the one that we were accused of, COVID-19 medical misinformation. So, yeah, that's really incredible that we spend time, and this was on the other show. This wasn't on WBAI. We talked about it a little bit, but because WBAI is a free speech radio station, nobody can turn us off. Well, sometimes people try to turn us off. As you might recall, that happened a while back. But people power works in the end, and that's why it's so important. And let me just say for a second, too, that's why it's important that you keep this place alive, because if it's not here, then we're stuck on YouTube. Then we're stuck with Google. They're the ones making the decision, and we don't have any power. You, the listener, you have power. You can vote. You can vote in the important bylaws elections that are happening right now to determine the future of the station. Yeah, and all sorts of other things as well. But that only happens if you continue to support the place. 212-209-2950 is the phone number. Call up, pledge whatever you can. but keep WBAI on the air. And, you know, for us to get preempted with no notice last week by accident and come back on the air this week and say support this place, you know it's got to mean something. You know it has to mean something to us. So anyway, yeah, we did battle with Google, and I guess we prevailed on that. But again, I want to see if it's that easy. I want to see if every single week somebody can simply say, hey, they're spreading medical misinformation, when all we're doing is telling the facts about the importance of a vaccine and the dangers of a virus. And if that is the case, well, then we have an interesting story, I think. Rob?
And I think it's also important to point out that we're not depending on Google. We're not depending on YouTube. You can always get hold of our show over the air, 99.5 FM. You can listen to this program. You can always find Off the Hook Overtime on our page, on our own chunk of the Internet, which we control, which is at 2600.com/offthehook. There is archives of this program, and there is archives of the audio from Off the Hook Overtime there as well.
Yeah, it's also important to point out that, as you said, when they took that video, and when we say video, it's really just one picture that has audio. This is our way of getting the audio out on YouTube. When they took that video down, they didn't take it down from our site because they can't control our site. We control our site. So it was always there. It was always around. It's just that particular outlet had been shut off. And really, we only use that outlet for the live aspect of it so that we can take phone calls and that we can broadcast to a lot of people. And it wasn't turned off then. And that's kind of weird, too. I guess they can't turn it off if it's live. If we're spouting medical malpractice or misinformation, they can't turn it off. And here's another challenge for you idiots out there who want to shut down free speech and spread misinformation. Yeah, see if you can turn us off live. Alex, I can see you're moving in your car, you're driving, but you seem to have stopped. What's going on?
I did. Actually, yeah, I have arrived at my destination.
Oh, how
and,
exciting.
Yeah, it is very exciting. It's wonderful. Thank God, you know. But I think, was this the first time I was driving during this past year? I think there might have been one other instance.
It looked cool.
Yeah, it looked really cool. Unfortunately, nobody else could appreciate it, but it looked cool to see you just moving on the screen.
I bet. Uh-huh. It would have been pretty neat, right? If only these things were video, I bet. But,
and, of course, you know, because of radio, we could be lying. None of this could be happening. We could all be in the studio, but we're not.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct.
So did you have anything to add to this conversation?
That,
Alex?
Yeah.
Okay.
To be fair. Yeah. Balance it out a little bit.
Maybe get a little closer to your hotspot in your house there.
There was a very short period.
Can you run to your hotspot, please?
Yeah, you know what?
Because right now all I see is your eye.
Let me get in the house.
All I see is your eye, and I can barely hear what you're saying. So, okay. Are you inside?
Right, I'll be back.
You'll be back. Okay. Well, then let's give this update right now on a couple other things that happened over the past couple of weeks. We announced that our HOPE conference, which was scheduled for this August at St. John's University in Queens, will not be happening after all this year. We'll be doing it next year, but we just we figured, despite the fact that everything is really progressing nicely, New York has just opened up again, and we're getting back to normal. We didn't want to make it any more stressful for people. We didn't want to add another task on top of everything else that we've got to put back together. And having a conference is great, but let's get our lives back. Let's have a little fun. Let's enjoy ourselves, and we'll make the best damn conference ever next year. This conference was only going to happen if everything was back to normal and we were going to make up for the one that we didn't have in person last year. Since that's not entirely the case, it would have to be somewhat reduced and subdued. We figured, why bother with that?
Also, the planning and preparation to host that kind of event really does depend on a lot of interactions, a lot of people coming into proximity, checking things out, and anyway, to say the least, it would have been a logistical real hassle.
And we're talking about people throughout the world. And in places where things aren't necessarily as good as they are here right now. We don't know where people are in their lives. We don't know where people are in their countries or in their households. We don't want to add more to that at this stage because the conference will be in a couple of months, and that's, you know, a lot of preparation has to go into these things. It's usually done months further in advance, but that was impossible because everybody was going through hell. So next year seems like the best course of action.
And why put people at risk at all if there's even a chance of that? We don't want to be a part of that. We want people to stay healthy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of what's going to be happening in the next few weeks is kind of an experiment. Kind of an experiment to see how it goes, to see if we are really past it, and if the amount of people who are not helping out is enough to really turn things in the other direction. We don't know yet. We don't know.
New York State's doing very well.
Yeah, we are. We are. 70% vaccinated. 75% out here on Long Island. I'm very impressed, and I'm not usually impressed. But anyway, the date, July 22nd through 24th, 2022, next year, July 22nd through 24th, that is the date for the next HOPE conference. As yet unnamed, maybe you have an ingenious name that you'd like to share with us. Our email address, oth@2600.com. Write to us. Tell us what your ideas are. We'd like to know. Also, 2600 meetings, still suspended. But starting next month, starting in July, we are going to start resuming at least some of them. We're going to start phasing them in, and we're going to base that on the overall statistics for each area, wherever they happen to be. And obviously some places are doing better than other places. So we can pretty much, I would say, Rob, I think we can count on New York coming back next month in whatever you call that damn mall uptown. Not Citigroup. the one near Citigroup.
Well, there is the atrium, but there are interesting developments regarding that.
Oh, yeah?
Because a lot of us who are regulars at the New York City 2600 meeting have been looking around at the venues. The atrium where we'd been meeting before lockdown is currently remodeling.
Wait. The one that we moved to because the other one was remodeling is now remodeling itself?
Oh, yes, indeed. It's been remodeling for a while.
Why does everyone have to remodel all the time? It was fine the way it was.
What's even funnier, a bunch of us went around on a field trip recently looking at that place, looking at Citigroup where we used to meet, and a lot of places, all the publicly owned, privately owned public spaces, rather, in the area, we were seeing closed signs on all of them. But just this week, the city government decided that the publicly owned or the privately owned public spaces, I'll get that right soon enough, that had been closed due to COVID have to reopen
right
on July 1st.
Oh wow!
So
it's like they know about our meetings, so they know it's gotta happen by then. Okay.
But of course, if their remodeling isn't finished, then they still can't open. So what we're doing is we are doing our best to get in touch with management of buildings and things like that, and we're kind of planning on a knife edge because it's the next meeting's in a few weeks. But we will keep you updated. Stay tuned to nyc2600.net or nyc2600 on Twitter to keep updated with what's going on for next month. And we also, whatever happens, if and when we reintroduce a physical meeting, we're still going to do what we can to involve people who want to attend virtually. And I suggest for people running meetings in other places, try and do such a thing as well. You know, have a laptop running, video conference software or something to that effect to continue to include people who are not yet comfortable attending physically.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Rob, will there be a call for supplies to help with the remodeling for hackers that may have some suggestions or maybe they can lend a hand, maybe they have a skill with some drywall or whatnot?
Yeah, they love that.
Yeah, I think if you have Elmer's glue and popsicle sticks, let us know.
Look, if the atrium is
lots
not...
Lots of googly eyes.
If the atrium is not finished with their remodeling by the meeting, surely Citigroup, which had been remodeling for years beforehand, is done with their remodeling. And they can't use that as an excuse. They can say, we don't like you, stay away. They can do that. But as you mentioned, it is a privately owned public space, whatever the
right
hell that means.
The last I checked with Citigroup, they were still several years behind on their remodeling project and had not yet.
Are you kidding me? They still haven't done it?
Yeah.
This
is moving at the speed of amazement.
You know, a good place to have a meeting?
And we will.
Moynihan Train Hall. Okay, it's big. It's spacious. And right now, there's not a lot of people in it, but that's a great place. And it, your voice echoes. It's amazing.
Actually, it's got great access by public transit.
Yeah, a lot of trains go there.
That should be a backup location, and then maybe it'll become a permanent fixture in the meetings.
So, okay, that's one meeting. That's New York City. As you can see, there's a lot of coordination and organization involved. If you are involved in any meeting anywhere, or if you want to be involved in any meeting anywhere, this is what we're doing is we're starting from scratch. We're not just going to relist all the meetings. So what's going to happen in the next couple of months is you'll see 2,600 meetings start to reemerge, and it'll seem like there are a lot fewer of them because there will be because we're starting from scratch and only working with the meetings that contact us. So if you go to the meeting section of 2600.com on the webpage, you'll get more information there. You can follow 2600 meetings. That's the number 2600, the word meetings, on Twitter. And you can DM, send a direct message to that particular entity if you have a meeting that you want to organize or that you want to resume. But we have to hear from everybody. Email address, meetings at 2600.com. Many, many ways to get in touch with us. And if you have a website or a Twitter ID of your own, we will be contacting you. But again, we'll only be listing the meetings that are in safe locations where things are at an acceptable status. We're only going to be communicating with those meetings who talk to us, who respond. So it'll be interesting. And if you want to start a new meeting, this is a great time to do it because you'll stand out all the more. There won't be we have like 60 meetings, 70 meetings. And for those who don't know, 2600 meetings, it's a unique concept that we've been doing since 1987. Started right there in New York City at the what was called the City Core Center back then. We basically have a bunch of people who are interested in technology, hacking, things like that, who meet in a public space, like a food court or even a bookstore cafe, places like that. Some groups go to hacker spaces, but it's better to get away from the computers and the technology and just hang out and talk. And best thing is meet new people who just wander by and say, "Hey, who are you people?" We've gotten so many good people to join up as a result of that. So we have the meetings. Generally, we have the meetings on the first Friday of every month. And it started with just one meeting in New York City, but then it grew. And we figured, why not keep meeting at the same day, basically the same time? Because back then in the 1980s, we were being followed a lot by federal agents. And we thought this would spread their reach thin if they had to follow everybody at the same time. Kidding aside, though, it makes it easy to remember when the meeting is. But we there are exceptions. There are exceptions. Again, meetings at 2600.com is our email address, or go to the meeting section of the 2600.com website. We'll have more information here as well.
I've missed that part of our columns,
yeah.
And having to update people on the special hiatus.
Yeah. Well, you missed the actual page in the magazine.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's been blank.
I missed the actual meetings that they talk about.
Yeah,
those are fun too. But yeah, our meetings page has been a disaster the last year.
Yeah, it's been rough. Mm. It's been rough.
Now, Alex, you've made it inside. Looks like everything is normal. Congratulations. Is there anything you'd like to share now that you have good connectivity?
Sure. I mean, while we're on the subject of 2600 meetings, I mean that's. Something that's near and dear to my heart because it's where you and I met many, many years ago back in the 90s. I think it was probably 1994 or something like that when we had the meetings it was the City Court building back then, and it was near that large bank of payphones. And I think a few weeks ago on Overtime, I read the beginning of my law review article from law school that was published in the Vermont Law Review in 2005, and I described that large bank of payphones as being really fascinating because it's where phone freaks from all over the world would call into at around 5 o'clock in New York. And it was just such a great place to meet interesting individuals, people that I met at 2600 meetings 25, you know, almost, you know, 30 years ago now, my God. I'm still friends with to this day. They're pretty extraordinary places. And I know in Vermont, when I lived in Vermont,
they meet or used to meet on Church Street in Burlington in the top floor of a McDonald's. So these meetings, you know, really run the gamut in terms of locations.
Yeah, and they exist everywhere. I've been to many British meetings. There are meetings in Japan, all over the place. You name it, Brazil, Argentina. It's an incredible way to bring people together, and the similarities, no matter where you happen to go, are striking.
And it's an incredible way to a catalyst and way to build strong hacker communities all over the world. And it has. It's really when you visit and travel, you can count on maybe finding a local space or a group that's interested in the kinds of things you are.
Yeah, and to call it a meeting is kind of a misnomer because there's no agenda. There's no leader. It's basically a gathering. It's basically hanging out in a food court or something equivalent. And just talking to the people you want to talk to. You don't have to talk to anybody you don't want to talk to. And nobody is in charge. We just ask that people obey the rules of whatever place they're in.
Sometimes there's discussion. Sometimes people lead.
Sure. Some meetings do it a little bit differently. Yes, Rob.
I also kind of appreciate that we're taking this opportunity to reboot the whole list that had been building up over the years and years, because we would often hear from people via email or whatever that, you know, they would say, oh, I went to where the magazine said such and such a meeting would be in such and such a place, and there was nobody there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a natural thing that events would sort of fade out or move or, you know, evolve in some way, but, you know, the list wasn't keeping up with what was going on in reality. So now we have this opportunity to restart everything, make sure that all the meetings we list are people we're in communication with that are active and are going to meet there.
And we'll be able to have our listing in the magazine in a font size bigger than 6 points, I think, right? Is that what we have now, Kyle? It's really tiny. You need a magnifying glass to read it.
I don't know. Any of our readers would know. It's getting smaller and smaller.
Well, it's going to be big for a little while.
People start them. So, uh-huh. we're going to go back to a bit more legible. There's just going to be less there, but it will grow, and that's the exciting part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Things have changed, though. Like Alex was saying, payphones. You can't call into payphones anymore if they're even there. You know, they don't take incoming calls, and many places don't even have payphones. The spirit, that is the same. That has not changed.
I noticed, too, at some of the locations I visited for meetings, you know, they're competing with other meetings, and there's other things that start up in whatever coffee shop or locale is chosen. So these things are dynamic. Sometimes, as we're talking about remodeling and stuff, there's other competing factors. So this is a great time to restart and rekindle that.
Were there Starbucks or Barnes & Noble when our first meeting started in 1987? I honestly don't know, but they certainly weren't everywhere like they are now. So that's something to think about. Okay, we have more news. All sorts of other things have been happening. Late-breaking reality winner has been released from prison. Former intelligence contractor jailed for leaking classified information. She was released from prison to serve her remaining sentence in a halfway house program. Winner's attorney, Allison Grinter, tweeted the news a couple of days ago, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons website lists her in custody of San Antonio's Residential Reentry Management Field Office, which oversees community-based programs for incarcerated people. I'm thrilled to announce that Reality Winner has been released from prison. She is still in custody in the residential reentry process, but we are relieved and hopeful, her lawyer tweeted in a statement. Reality and her family have asked for privacy during the transition process as they work to heal the trauma of incarceration and build back the years lost. Her release is not a product of the pardon or compassionate release process, but rather the time earned from exemplary behavior while incarcerated. She is still barred from public statements or appearances, and the Bureau of Prisons website still lists her release date as November 23rd, 2021. Still, good news that one more person is no longer incarcerated. If you recall, she was she the one who was incarcerated because her data was somehow leaked? Was it The Intercept?
Yes, this was the case involving Microdots. A more recent case involving Microdots, and I think The Intercept was involved with publishing the document without transcribing it in a way that couldn't share those, and they ended up being quite revealing about the location of where the printouts were made.
Uh-huh. Yes, Gila, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I had an itch.
Oh, okay. Alex, go ahead.
Sorry.
Alex, do you have an itch, or do you have something to say?
Kyle's exactly right about this. This was the case I had to deal with the microdots. And more importantly, that I think the documents that Reality Winner had taken from the government in violation of, I believe it was the Espionage Act, or transmitting classified information, rather, were incredibly important to our public understanding of the 2016 Russian campaign for election interference. And so Reality Winner, by taking these documents, these classified documents, and transmitting them to a journalistic outfit like The Intercept, you know, and for full disclosure, I've written for The Intercept in the past, it's been quite a few years, but I have written for them. She was a whistleblower. She was engaging in whistleblowing activities here because the Russian activities that were the subject of the documents she had exfiltrated were taken, stolen, released, whatever verb you want to use for it, indicated that Russian intelligence, or the GRU, I believe, was targeting a Florida-based voting entity and also seeking to spearfish certain high-ranking election officials in the state of Florida. So we did not know this and would not know this, but for, I think, in my opinion, the really selfless acts of Reality Winner. Mm-hmm. And she paid a very, very hefty price for this. I don't think that she thought that she was going to get caught, but you know, this underscores, I think, the real importance of how any kind of press agency or media outlet handles source information and publishes source information. It can literally be a matter of life and death. I mean, just like any intelligence agency, you have to protect your sources and your methods. And that's this is a case that really underscores that, had a very tragic outcome for, I think, information that was squarely within the public interest. Is also, I think, of note that Reality Winner sought a pardon from Donald Trump on the basis of her whistleblowing activities, but was denied.
Yeah, and it was especially, it seems a little out of context now, but at the time, I think if you look at some of what was going on, I can't even really, I don't have one specific detail I can point to, but it was a time where a lot of the information about that was being suppressed.
Well, okay, so good news on that front, hopefully she'll adjust to life in the free world as soon as possible. There's a documentary. I haven't seen this documentary. I've heard good things about it, though. United States versus Reality Winner premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival earlier this year. So that might be something to for people to catch up on what this story is all about and what she was all about. One thing we were going to mention last week, it was a particularly good week for the feds. My goodness. The FBI was able to recover millions of dollars in cryptocurrency that was paid to the ransomware hackers that targeted Colonial Pipeline. Not the kind of thing you think is possible. Listen to this interview with the Wall Street Journal that FBI Director Christopher Wray participated in. He said coordination between ransomware victims and law enforcement can, in some cases, yield positive results for both parties. It's kind of funny that he says that cooperating with the FBI sometimes can result in positive results. Many times not, though. I don't want to suggest that this is the norm, but there have been instances where we've even been able to work with our partners to identify the encryption keys, which then would enable a company to actually unlock their data even without paying the ransom. Does anybody know what he's talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I mean, if a threat actor, some kind of criminal or ransomware gang, mm-hmm. had used the same key somewhere else to encrypt someone else's data, and the FBI or law enforcement had assisted in decrypting that data, they might have copies of those particular keys and be able to reuse them in decrypting this data, or they might have some kind of covert capability or covert access to the threat actors' systems themselves
acquire those keys and hand them over to the affected organization.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. According to the report I'm looking at here, in some cases, U.S. officials can find the ransomware operators and own their network within hours of an attack. That basically allows relevant agencies to monitor their communications and potentially identify additional key players in the group responsible. When ransomware actors are more careful with their operational security, including in how they move money, disrupting their networks or tracing the currency becomes more complicated. So if you're a ransomware operator, you need to take a course in how to safely run your network to avoid this kind of thing from happening to you.
And it shows you there are absolutely levels to the kinds of games people are playing out there.
It also shows you that for all the complaining that we hear about how technology is leaving law enforcement behind, no, it's not leaving them behind at all. This proves it. This shows that if you're good at what you do, if you're clever, if you're smart, you can figure it out. You can outsmart them. And, I applaud the FBI for doing this. They actually were able to win one for the good guys.
I think also what they're saying, if you read between it a little, is that the more cases people report that have affected institutions, they're increasingly having a broader view, a map, basically mapping out how keys and parts of the blockchain are being used and then what networks they're associated with or what service providers are being used wherever and in whatever case. So the more people are open about it, the more tools they can apply from history and other investigations they've done, which makes sense.
Can you imagine, though, being a ransomware operator who's just siphoned off millions of dollars from some company, losing it all because your network was compromised by the federal authorities? I mean, the symmetry is perfect. And, I'm blown away by it. Go ahead, Alex.
Look, I think it happens in more cases than we hear about. I have worked on and am working on a couple of matters that have to deal with the theft of cryptocurrency and the return of the currency. And I will say, everybody operates on this erroneous assumption. Not everybody. As I would say, a lot of people operate on the erroneous assumption that Bitcoin is some untraceable magic. It certainly is not. I mean, Bitcoin is the coin du jour because it's easily accessible and widely available for this type of payment. They then put this through different coin swappers or mixers. But all of this ultimately is traceable. And I think even if you're stealing Bitcoin or if you are requesting a ransom, I would say in a good percentage of cases, the majority of the cases, the threat actors, the criminal groups responsible for these ransomware attacks, likely do not get away with exfiltrating or edging out into fiat currency the 100% of the money that was paid into the ransom. And that's because the money is traceable and very often frozen when it's in other currencies or other exchanges. And, I wound up actually writing an article last week for CNN, an opinion article for CNN, where I talk about the role of ransomware and cryptocurrency and how cryptocurrency essentially fuels the ransomware industry, and that because we are now seeing a change in attitudes towards paying these ransoms and more KYC or know your customer requirements that are ubiquitous through cryptocurrency exchanges and more popular exchanges like Coinbase being a force for good in this group, in this land of cryptocurrency, we're going to start seeing cryptocurrency and ransomware, I think, decreasing over time. But in the immediate future, the access that these criminal enterprises have, these threat actors have, they want to try to monetize it as quickly as possible. Because if you think about how the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack worked, it was ransomware as a service, which means that the creators of the ransomware, DarkSide, they did not necessarily have access to Colonial Pipeline. Some different group of criminal bandits or threat actors had access to Colonial Pipeline, and they deployed the DarkSide group's ransomware on it. At the end of the day, they would split a certain percentage of the ransomware that was paid to them. So now those that have access are in a race to monetize it, and those that have developed the ransomware are in a race to monetize it because of all of these regulatory changes, including changes from the insurance industry itself, where insurance companies are now beginning to look askance at paying out ransoms because it may be against public policy. It also may even violate sanctions, U.S. sanctions. Some of these criminal groups have been placed on sanctions list or on the OFAC list by the U.S. government, and so paying them may even be illegal. So all of this, I think, is coming to a head right now, where we're going to see a higher velocity of ransomware events. But over time, I'm really hopeful that they'll decrease without destroying cryptocurrencies themselves.
But a couple of things you said strike me. Now, if it's illegal to pay a criminal, doesn't that make every single kidnapping something that can't be resolved? You can't pay a ransom. You can't legally pay a ransom because the person who is demanding a ransom is a criminal and is being sanctioned.
Well, it wouldn't be every criminal. It would be certain groups.
Well, why wouldn't you sanction every criminal?
Well, you could, but it would be difficult to keep up with the gangs and the naming conventions. I think known threat actors that do this regularly or that may be state-sponsored or operate within a state that has turned a blind eye to their particular activities or they have some kind of immunity from prosecution, those are the types of groups that we can likely see being placed on sanctions lists that would prevent U.S. companies affected by their ransomware deployments from paying the actual ransom.
The other thing, you mentioned that cryptocurrency is in many cases traceable. Does that mean, though, that it's accessible? My understanding is that you might be able to see what's going on in a ledger. It doesn't mean that you have access to the people that are actually doing it or can find out any actual information.
Yeah, if there are ways of doing it, would you want to talk about it?
That's true, too.
Yeah, well, it is to a certain extent, right? And it all depends on where the currencies end up and on what exchange and whether that exchange has some kind of reasonable KYC type of requirement, some reasonable know-your-customer requirement.
I stop at that, Alex, right away. This KYC thing, it's not working. First of all, it's a silent K, so that doesn't work right there, but I hate those acronyms. So, you know, in corporate boardrooms, I know people talk like that, but not on 99.5 FM, I'm sorry.
All right, well, I don't know, we'll call them some kind of, you know, disclosure requirements for opening up a particular account.
There you go.
Also, that doesn't get you out of the ambit of, let's say, an account is hijacked by a threat group that's used as some kind of mule to launder the money. I mean, these types of disclosure requirements for opening up an account, I think they're going to be more and more forthcoming, especially if they're a condition of doing business with larger exchanges like Coinbase and Celsius.
Yeah, I had a real problem. Like, the news cycle really ran with this, and it made me a little bit annoyed just at just how sensational and the reaction, like, and the confusing of various things. The sort of allegation that Bitcoin didn't work anymore because the investigative entities in these cases were actually doing their jobs and, you know, putting things together and coming up with ways to work to the victim's favor. But it was being cast as this, like, end of cryptocurrency or what is even the point anymore? Fareed Zakaria did a really, like, a bit of a preamble on this that was pretty nauseating. And it was just like, well, why not we just go to these, you know, all of the functions of it except for the dangerous parts. And I just looked at that and I'm like, well, why is it this particular cryptocurrency that's broke? I mean, you would just start up another one. There are so many of them anyway. But for some reason, Bitcoin was the bad one. And it's just, it became this huge attention-getting thing when it really didn't serve the ends of the people that were using it and the public as far as awareness and of what was going on.
Gila, either the sun is in your eyes or you have something to say.
No, I actually do have something
to
say this time.
Good.
I know, it's exciting. No, because Kyle, when you said it got huge, and this is, of course it did. It did because it had to, because of the severity of the hack, if you will, of the negative. Like, people were putting gas into plastic bags. Someone had the answer for it. This is why people cared. This is why people zoomed in on it. Nobody knows anything about Bitcoin, but a lot of people don't. And people just needed to see, okay, the bad guys are doing X. X is bad. And it's a really, I think, oversimplification, which I'm actively oversimplifying now. But I think it's sort of leading to a demonization of cryptocurrency, because if the only people who are interested in it are Elon Musk and people who are making me put gas in plastic bags, it's not something I'm interested in.
Okay, can I just say something about the gas and plastic bags thing that people in Carolina were doing? That's, you can't blame that on the ransomware people. That's, there's something else going on there, and we need to focus on it. When people go around doing that kind of thing, there are issues. And I was blown away by that myself.
I think it's benzene poisoning.
I don't know what it is, but it needs attention. But, hey, this story continues, because this wasn't the only victory that the FBI had. Now, there were there was this case in Australia, I'm sure many of us have heard about, for years. Organized crime figures around the globe were reacting on these cell phones that basically had a calculator app on them, and the calculator app was basically hiding what the phone really did, which was sending encrypted messages and photos. So all these organized crime figures were using these devices to orchestrate international drug shipments, coordinate the trafficking of arms and explosives, discuss contract killings. You know, it's basically a festival of organized crime. They trusted the device's security so much that they often laid out their plans not in code but in plain language, mentioning specific smuggling vessels and drop-off points. Unbeknownst to them, however, their entire network was actually a sophisticated sting run by the FBI in coordination with the Australian police. Unbelievable. A week ago Tuesday, global law enforcement officials revealed the unprecedented scope of the three-year operation, saying they had intercepted over 20 million messages in 45 languages and arrested at least 800 people, most of them in the past a couple of days, in more than a dozen countries. And using the messages, U.S. court papers say the authorities have opened a barrage of international investigations into drug trafficking, money laundering, and high-level public corruption. The FBI's operation, according to court documents that the Justice Department unsealed a week ago Monday, had its origins in early 2018 after the Bureau dismantled a Canadian-based encryption service called Phantom Secure. That company, officials said, supplied encrypted cell phones to drug gangs like Mexico's Sinaloa cartel and other criminal groups. Now, seeing a void in the underground market, the FBI recruited a former Phantom Secure distributor who had been developing a new encrypted communication system called ANOM. The informant agreed to work for the FBI and let the Bureau control the network for the possibility of a reduced prison sentence. He let them control the whole damn network just for the possibility of a reduced prison sentence. They also paid him $120,000. ANOM devices were cell phones that had been stripped of all normal functions. Their only working app was disguised as the calculator function. After entering a code, users could send messages and photos with end-to-end encryption. Over 3 years, more than 12,000 ANOM devices were sold to over 300 criminal syndicates operating in more than 100 countries. The devices' cost varied by location, but were generally sold on six-month subscriptions available for about $1,700 in the United States. Working with the Australian authorities, the FBI and the informant developed a master key that allowed them to reroute the messages to a third country and decrypt them, ultimately intercepting more than 27 million messages. The authorities also relied on the informant to get the devices into the highly insular criminal networks. The informant started in October 2018 by offering the devices to three other distributors with connections to organized crime in Australia. And that informant, I would imagine, he has got to be under double secure secret witness relocation onto another planet, because he is no friend of many, many people right now. But boy, what a coup! What a coup for the FBI and law enforcement everywhere. And again, another indication of how, yeah, you can outsmart encryption. You can do it if you have a plan, if you work together and you're smart. Rob?
And it's not the encryption here that was weak. It was the fact that the criminal underworld let themselves get talked into buying a fake secure app that was under the control of the people, trying to catch them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they'd gone to open source, this would never have happened.
Yeah, I guess that's another argument for open source. I guess, go ahead, Alex.
I mean, speaking of protection of sources and methods, I mean, really, you have to hand it to the FBI and law enforcement agencies the world over that were working in coordination with FBI that, you know, they really pulled this off. I mean, keeping this secret, monitoring this, making sure that nobody was going to make an arrest or have a prosecution where this type of methodology was going to be disclosed in a court proceeding. I mean, they kept us under wraps for 3 years. That's I have to say, that's a great job on the part of law enforcement to keep this thing operating. You know, and also, as Rob mentioned, too, this just underscores the very fact that many of us don't necessarily understand how this technology works. We power up our iPhones. It's sort of magic. We all assume that signal or wire or telegram or whatever it is perfectly secure. We don't look under the hood. We need the right to look under the hood to make sure that our privacy is not subject to the same type of insecurities based on the assumptions that these criminals make.
Oh, wow, my phone has a calculator. I just found it. I didn't know my phone had a calculator.
I bet, yeah. But it really is incredible how they pulled this off. And I was wondering when I read the story, God, what were they privy to and what did they let pass by and happen with their knowledge just to keep this type of operation secret?
It's incredible. And again, you know, congrats to FBI for pulling this off. But by pulling off these two things, you're also demonstrating that you can operate in today's technology just fine. You don't need to have backdoors into everybody's phone or a spy on everybody's internet account. No, you can use the prevailing landscape and use your criminal detection skills to win in the end. It's not that difficult. We are almost out of time. I want to remind people to pledge to WBAI 212-209-2950 or go to give2wbai.org. We had a letter from somebody. Hang on, let me try and track this down. One of many people, hopefully, who have contributed. This is from Thomas. Not looking for any recognition. Well, too bad, Thomas, you're getting it. however, I'm donating monthly since I faithfully listen to Off the Hook. And I would like to credit my monthly donation to that program. Thank you so much, Tom, for that generous donation. You can be like Tom. Give a call to 212-209-2950. Go to give2wbai.org. You can become a BAI buddy. Pledge every month. And by doing that, when you pledge every month, it adds up to a bigger number over an entire year. And everybody wins. Write to us, oth@2600.com, with your emails if you have something to say to us. And Rob, I think you have something to say right now.
Yes, and if you're already a member of BAI, do cast your vote in the Pacifica Bylaws Vote. Go to wbai.org/bylawsvote.html for more info on that.
Yeah, remember, the station is it's imperfect. It's a work in progress, but it's been around since 1960, and it's ours. And Google can't kick us off it. So it's a treasure worth preserving. So do whatever you can to make that happen. We'll be back on these airwaves next week at this time. Well, we'll be leaving this time, but at 7 o'clock we'll be coming back on. In a few minutes at 8 p.m. we'll be going to Off the Hook Overtime on YouTube. You get there by going to channel 2600 on YouTube or by clicking on the link that appears at the top of the 2600.com webpage. We'll have more updates on various things going on as we transition back to normalcy. Remember, folks, get that vaccine if you haven't already. And join us on Overtime as we no doubt get shut off for medical misinformation. We'll see. Good night. Ha ha ha!
They came after Julian, not for his vices, but for his virtues.
Journalist Chris Hedges on why the persecution of Julian Assange.
They came after Julian because he exposed the more than 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, because he exposed the torture and abuse of some 800 men and boys aged between 14 and 89 at Guantanamo, because he exposed that Hillary Clinton, in 2009, ordered U.S. diplomats to spy on U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other U.N. representatives from China, France, Russia, and the U.K., spying that included obtaining DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, and personal passwords, part of the long pattern of illegal surveillance that included the eavesdropping on U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan in the weeks before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Because he exposed that Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the CIA orchestrated the June 2009 military coup in Honduras that overthrew the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya, replacing it with a murderous and corrupt military regime. Because he exposed that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and David Petraeus prosecuted a war in Iraq that under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression, a war crime. That they authorized hundreds of targeted assassinations, including those of U.S. citizens in Yemen, and that they secretly launched missile, bomb, and drone attacks on Yemen, killing scores of civilians. Because he exposed that Goldman Sachs paid Hillary Clinton $657,000 to give talks, a sum so large it can only be considered a bribe. And that she privately assured corporate leaders she would do their bidding while promising the public financial regulation reform. Because he exposed the internal campaign to discredit and destroy British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn by members of his own party. Because he exposed how the hacking tools used by the CIA and the National Security Agency permits the wholesale government surveillance of our televisions, computers, smartphones, and antivirus software, allowing the government to record and store our conversations, images, and private text messages, even from encrypted apps.
Tune in to Radio Unnameable Thursday at midnight to hear Hedges and more on the power of moral resistance and the importance of protecting whistleblowers and journalists and to advocate for the release of Julian Assange. That's midnight on Thursday, Radio Unnameable, here on listener-sponsored, non-commercial, locally controlled WBAI New York.